I'm very happy now to welcome to the program David Shirk. He is director of the Transborder Institute. He's associate professor in the Department of Political Science in the University of San Diego, and he will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at the James A. Little Theater as part of the Lannan Foundation series In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your specialty is Mexico, and you started a good decade ago looking at Mexico and looking at some of the changes, political changes that happened when Mexico went from being essentially a one-party state to the election of Vicente Fox and being what might be called a multi-party state, and looking specifically at questions of rule of law, questions of violence, questions of drugs. What did Mexico look like about a decade ago, let's say at the turn of the century?
You know, it's Mexico, I'd say a decade ago, was exuberant about the advances it had made politically as a country. There was a tremendous sense of optimism that they had passed this important hurdle in their development of creating a new democracy. And when Vicente Fox came to power, people, I think, were really excited that change was going to come to Mexico, and change was really possible in Mexico, a country that for not decades but centuries has had tremendous poverty and inequality. People saw this transformational moment as an opportunity for Mexico to make itself a better country. And of course, in order for democracy to work, you have to have rule of law. And this was one of the early priorities of the Fox administration. It was an issue that scholars and academics and experts focused on Mexico became more and more concerned about in the 2000s. Because at the same time that Mexico was going through this wonderful democratic transformation, it was struggling with the problems of rising crime and violence, and particularly the problem of organized crime, which was becoming more prevalent, more violent, and more of a problem for ordinary Mexican society.
Now, by organized crime, are we talking specifically about drug cartels?
Predominantly about drug cartels. Now, in the 1990s, you started to see small groups of criminals getting involved in kidnapping, bank robberies, and things like that. But the real muscle in organized crime in Mexico, and the real the lucrative side of organized crime, is found in drug trafficking. Drug trafficking is extremely profitable in Mexico and around the world, because the prohibition of drugs that are widely used in the United States and other developed countries makes it the most profitable activity that any organized crime group can possibly get involved in. So the most accessible. Smuggling nuclear weapons perhaps is very profitable, but it's not easily
you can't grow
accessible.
Those.
Can't grow your own nukes. So, yes, the dominant form of organized crime in Mexico is drug trafficking. Of course, drug trafficking came to Mexico after the major drug cartels of Colombia were defeated or seriously weakened in the 1980s and early 90s through Plan Colombia begins in 1999, but there were serious U.S. and Colombian efforts to take down the Colombian cartels, as well as the leftist rebel groups that were smuggling drugs, as well as the paramilitary. So as we saw Colombia become less of a hub for the control of the drug trade, Mexico's drug cartels began to take over. And this was around the 1980s and early 90s.
I think it's instructive just to look at that and think about the fact that when drug trafficking is weakened in one place, it just grows up in another.
That's
right. It's
not
like you're getting rid of it.
No, and you know, people who specialize on drug trafficking and organized crime refer to this as the balloon effect. You squeeze a balloon in one area, and all you do is to displace the air inside and cause it to go somewhere else. In Mexico, they have a different metaphor. They call it the cucaracha effect. You walk into a room, you turn on the lights, the cockroaches scatter and they go to another place that's dark. However you want to describe it, the real problem is that the drug trade as long as there is a demand for drugs, for illicit drugs, and as long as it is profitable to traffic in illicit drugs, there will be a supply. It's basically a market-driven activity, and as long as the market's there,
well, and it's like that for everything. So if there's a market for cigars, someone is going to get you cigars. If there's market for chocolate candy, someone's going to supply chocolate candy, whatever it is.
That's right. And now, there are markets for everything. There are markets for things that are totally abhorrent to society. Child pornography is a good example. There's a market for it. Does that mean we should tolerate that market? No, not if the vast majority, 99.9% of society, sees that as an amoral market. That makes it a lot easier to fight that market, and it's probably right to fight that market. But when you have half of your population that buys into the market, half of your population that admits to drug use at some point in their life, and half your population that actually supports the idea of legalization of certain drugs, and particularly marijuana, that's a hard market to fight. It's trying to fight half your population, and it makes actually, for example, marijuana one of the major law enforcement problems that we have to deal with. 6% of arrests in the United States, about a little more than 1 in 5 arrests that we make, are a result of marijuana-related activity. So either smuggling or using marijuana. That's an awful lot of law enforcement resources directed to a crime that an awful lot of people are involved in.
And an awful lot of people think shouldn't be a crime in the first place. We can get back to that and the whole question of supply and who's using. Let's go back to Mexico for a moment. So by the time Vicente Fox came into office in the year 2000 and disrupted the idea of the one-party system, the previous party that his party, the PAN, displaced, had been in power for a very long time. What happened? How did that affect the dynamics of the drug cartels in Mexico?
So Mexico is a monopoly or a monopolistic society. I think that's partly because of the high degree of inequality in Mexico. It makes it easy for a small group of elites to control markets and power. And for 71 years, you had one party in power, one party state under the Institutional Revolutionary Party, as you mentioned. And that meant that control of virtually everything in Mexico came down to the PRI. If you wanted to get a permit to run a business, a newspaper, whatever, you had to have the support or permission of the PRI. It was similar with organized crime. And so organized crime networks were very tapped into high-level government officials. They corrupted in the 1990s, for example, the Mexican drug czar himself. And if you can get that kind of access in a one-party state, you have carte blanche to run your organized crime outfit. Well, when there was a change in the power structure, a diversification of the power structure, it made it possible and perhaps necessary for organized crime groups to divide up in a way that they had not before. That you started to see it in the 1990s as the PAN and other parties captured state governments. There were new points of entry to corrupt the state and new people that you could bring into your corruption networks. And I think that contributed to the proliferation of organized crime groups that were now in competition with one another. You introduce competition to the market.
So when you have a one-party system, you kind of can have a one-cartel state, and when you have a multi-party system, then suddenly multiple cartels can flourish depending on whom they can bribe.
Right, and it may not be necessarily because of the parties, but rather the people, that you're bringing in new people that can support different organizations or who may have different ties. So we don't necessarily want to say that the PRI was more corrupt than the PAN, or that if you go back to a one-party state, you're going to solve this. It really, I think, comes down to the points of contact between the state and organized crime. We know that in the 1990s, that began to diversify, and by the 2000s, it came full blossom. And what we also know is that you know, you move from having one or two major cartels in Mexico in the 1980s when the PRI was really strong to four cartels in the 1990s as it began to lose power. And today, probably somewhere around seven or eight major cartel organizations that operate regionally throughout Mexico. So competition has come to Mexico both politically and in terms of the violence. And the violence has been democratized in a way that it now begins to affect ordinary people on a day-to-day basis in a way that it didn't in the past.
What does that look like?
It's very ugly. Last year, Mexico had over 16,000 officially documented homicides from January to September of 2011. That's probably a rate of homicide total nationwide of at least 18 per 100,000. Here in the United States, we're somewhere around five or six per 100,000 on average for the last 10 years. So you're talking about a rate of homicide that's four or five times what we have in the United States. And to talk about it in those cold statistical terms is really to do an injustice to the victims of the violence, because the kind of killing we're talking about includes horrific acts of torture prior to killing the individual in question, gruesome mutilations, cutting off of body parts, putting those body parts into orifices. It includes the decapitation of people. It includes markings on the body, whether it's painting or cutting into the body to send specific messages. There is a whole alphabet language of killing that is used to communicate messages to whether it's your rivals or to the government that is, it's just unimaginable. The creativity of how to kill someone and how to hurt someone is only limited by the imagination. And I have seen in working with medical forensic officers in Mexico or agents in Mexico, I've seen things that you couldn't possibly describe without offending people.
Why are they doing it? In other words, why are these victims chosen? I mean, if you think about drug cartels as essentially illicit corporations that are distributing a product and taking it from point A and selling it at a profit in point B, where does this horrific, gruesome violence against civilians come in?
There's a couple of things, and that's a hugely important question. I mean, if you are a legal organization, if you are Philip Morris and you sell tobacco, if another organization comes in and violates your copyright or infringes on a contract, you have a legal recourse to deal with that conflict or that problem. If you're an organized crime group and you have a problem with your competitors, you don't have the backing of a legal system. You can't turn to the state and say, "Hey, solve this problem for me." So you have to solve it yourself, and the only real way to do so is the use of force.
So these are conflicts among competing drug cartels, as opposed to ordinary civilians getting caught in the crossfire?
Yes. For the most part, what we can say is that the people who are being killed, the 16,000 or so from last year, and just that's actually the first three quarters of last year, so it's probably somewhere around 18,000, possibly as high as 20,000 for all of 2011. The vast majority of the victims, at least 75%, are certainly involved in some way in organized crime. Now, it's difficult for us to know exactly what the face of victims is because the Mexican government has kept a very tight lid on the information about official drug-related homicides. There are a few people and a few organizations that have been trying to track the violence and get a better picture of who's really dying out there. For example, there's a librarian here in New Mexico named Molly Malloy, who is doing has been for the last few years doing a listserv where she tallies the number of people killed each day in Ciudad Juarez, the murder city, the murder capital.
I mean, that's a place where just girls are getting killed. Certainly they're not part of a competing cartel dynamic, are they?
No. And that's a place where you're seeing children killed at birthday parties or, random school kids killed on the way to school. But the question is, in the total number, what fraction do they represent? And the Mexican government claims that something like 95% of the victims are involved in organized crime. I tend to doubt that. We know that 7% of the victims, at least, are law enforcement and military personnel. So there's got to be a better accounting of who is dying in Mexico's drug war. There needs to be a real counting of the dead and get a better face of how this affects ordinary people. But for the most part, I think the primary effect on ordinary citizens in Mexico is the fear factor. The fear of leaving your home at night, the fear of driving after dark, the fear that you could be picked up and recruited by the Zetas if you live in a small rural area or some other drug cartel organization.
Now, who are the Zetas?
So, as I mentioned, there were a small number of drug trafficking organizations in the 80s and 90s. Back in the late 90s and early 2000s, one of those four organizations that operated in the 1990s, the Gulf Cartel, was beginning to fight against the other three organizations, the Sinaloa Cartel, the Juarez Cartel, the Tijuana Cartel. And they needed a little more muscle, a little more firepower. And they noticed that the Mexican government had created a specially vetted, highly trained counter-drug unit called the GAFIS, which was an acronym that referred to amphibious fighting force in Mexico. And these were basically Mexico's version of the Navy SEALs mixed with the Untouchables. It was Elliot Ness in military garb. And What OCL Cardenas, the leader of the Gulf Cartel, found was they weren't so untouchable. He could actually recruit dozens of these guys to start working for him.
They took the elite anti-drug military forces of Mexico and recruited them to be drug cartel operatives.
Exactly. And so you now brought into the conflict a level of brutality and really precision and sort of ruthlessness that is militarized. I mean, the Zetas, as they came into the fight, they're the ones who started with the decapitations and the mutilation and the messaging. And you use that kind of messaging. One of my colleagues, Gordon Hansen at the University of California, San Diego, said, you know, you use this kind of violence, this high profile, very, putting messages on the bodies. You use that kind of violence when you're communicating to someone you don't have very good communication with, when you're sending a message to someone that it's not easy to pick up the phone and talk to. You take a body, you hang it from a bridge, you put a sign on it. That's a very vocal kind of communication. And that's true, but it's also true that part of their design, part of their effort, is to terrify the population, terrify the authorities, and to let them know that you don't mess with us. That, I think, is a new aspect of Mexico's drug violence. And it's part of the reason that some people say what Mexico's problem is today is a problem of narco-terrorism. Or an insurgency against the government. And I think we have to be very careful about the kind of language we use and the kind of rhetoric we use, and because that shapes the policies we employ. If we think about Mexico as a narco-insurgency or as dealing with a problem of terrorism, which there's no doubt that it's terrifying, the kind of violence that's happening. But if we think about these guys as insurgents or terrorists, both insurgents and terrorists have political motivations. They're not out to make a buck. They're out to make a point or change a government. Drug traffickers are just businessmen who operate on the wrong side of the law. And if we legalized drugs, for example, they would become Philip Morris. Right? But as it is now, These are guys who are not trying to make a political point. They are operating in a marketplace, and we have to understand them as illicit business organizations if we want to figure out how to fight them.
We're talking to David Shirk, who will be speaking tonight as part of the Lannan Foundation series In Search of Cultural Freedom. I was watching the Turner Classic Movie Channel the other night, and the 1950s Al Capone movie was on, and I saw that part where Prohibition is passed, and Al Capone jumps for joy. He's thrilled because his crime organization can now flourish, providing this stuff, alcohol, in that case, in an illicit manner. You talked for a moment about drug legalization as a way of addressing this whole issue, but talk about the various policy options that you are studying as a political science of how both Mexico and the United States can understand and start to deal with the situation that Mexico faces right now.
Well, you know, the prohibition example is completely relevant because when you create an illicit market by creating a policy of restricting access to certain goods that are widely in demand, you raise the price of that commodity in a way that in the black market, in a way that makes it very profitable for suppliers to traffic in that substance. So in the United States, it was alcohol in the 1920s. And the criminalization of alcohol consumption made it profitable for guys like Al Capone to traffic in alcohol.
And did people like Al Capone then go out of business when Prohibition was overturned?
Well, you know, it's interesting because during Prohibition, first of all, one of the things that happened is that the supply networks moved abroad. So we saw Canadian suppliers and Mexican suppliers of alcohol develop and smuggling networks from both of those countries. And unfortunately, unlike Canada, in Mexico, some of those smuggling networks stayed there because what organized crime in the United States moved into next was the smuggling of heroin and to a certain extent, marijuana. So organized crime groups in the U.S., when we legalized, simply found new areas to move into. They moved into gambling, prostitution, and drug trafficking. If you look at the history of American film, it's actually very interesting. You look at movies like The Godfather or the Orson Welles film, A Touch of Evil. When you look at the history of American film, it does a good job of tracing the shifting of supply networks into the United States. And organized crime groups in the U.S. Moved to where the money was. When we took away alcohol, they moved into drug trafficking. We started to do a better job of fighting organized crime groups in the 1950s and 60s. We broke the French Connection in the 1960s. In the 1980s, we broke the Miami connection through Miami Vice, and that shifted the networks into Mexico. My sense is that we can continue to shift the networks as much as we want by applying pressure in Mexico. We could eventually shift the network, the drug traffickers, from operating in Mexico to Guatemala and the Caribbean, which is actually where the Zetas have started to move and some of the other drug trafficking activities have started to move. But at the end of the day, if we want to address this market-driven problem of drug consumption, we have to look ourselves in the eye and say, you know, how do we really want to deal with the fact that half of Americans consume some kind of drug in their lifetime, that there's a demand for this product, and that if used properly, if used in a controlled setting, the harms are there. There are real harms from drug use, but relatively speaking, the harms are far less to allow people to use drugs than they are to try to restrict them. Because the harms Mexico's experiencing, thousands of killings each year, that's an awful large toll in human life.
Well, and also the burglary and theft and violence in this country by people who are drug addicts to get money to get drugs. But, I mean, there's another dimension to it that I think is important to talk about, which is that why are we a society that needs so many drugs? I mean, when you talk about the market for drugs and the strength of these cartels, the consumption is basically us. It's the United States. So what is our society like that we take so many drugs?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. Is there something morally wrong with us? Is there something that our society falls short in terms of living up to the American dream? Are people depressed? There's no question in my mind that the use of drugs, particularly the abuse of drugs, to the point of becoming a healthcare problem for someone, whether it's alcohol or any kind of drug, it's a sign of another affliction, which is perhaps spiritual, perhaps emotional, but it's clear that many people who use drugs have other problems that lead them to that family situation, work situation, what have you. And those kinds of problems should be better addressed, in my view, by talking about your problems, addressing your problems, seeking personal guidance, whether it's spiritual or otherwise, to help you resolve your personal problems. We don't think about this issue in that way.
Not to mention societal problems like massive economic inequality.
Exactly. Poverty, the stress that's related to the very, very difficult economic times that we're currently living in. So one thing we really, whether or not we choose legalization as the option, it's clear to me that we need to talk more seriously as a country, as a community, about what we can do about the demand for drugs. Whether drugs are legal or illegal, we need to look that problem straight in the eye. The other thing, obviously, that we need to do, in my view, is to address one of the sources of violence in Mexico that's very significant, and that's U.S. guns. The assault weapons ban in the United States was lifted naturally. It expired a little less than 10 years ago, just at the wrong time for Mexico.
So all those guns that they're killing each other and killing people with in Mexico are U.S.-made guns traveling south.
You know, when we say all those guns, we have to be very careful because we don't know the exact proportion. Some of those guns are guns that are obtained from the Mexican military. Some are guns that come from Central American conflicts that date back 30 years. But the best guns, the most powerful guns that are being used in the Mexican conflict come from the United States because we are the world's number one producer and exporter of weapons. And whether it's 50%, 75%, 99%, we need to do something to help Mexico restrict or reduce the supply of those guns. At the end of the day, however, in my view, it's sort of like the drug problem. It's a market. If there's demand, the guns will come from somewhere. It will come from the United States or they'll come from somewhere else. We can do something more than we're doing now to limit the supply of really, really dangerous killing machines that are being shipped south. But at the end of the day, as long as these organized crime groups are going to be there, as long as they're well-financed and fighting against each other, we are kind of constrained in how much we can do on the guns front. But we are not doing enough. Until very recently, we were not attempting to restrict southbound flows of weapons. We weren't inspecting at the border to find out if guns were flowing south. And except for the state of California, there is no ban on the sale of assault weapons in anywhere in the Southwest. So if you want to get an AK-47 imported from Eastern Europe, you can get it somewhere in Texas and you can get a whole bunch of them and you can move them south. And that is a very serious problem for Mexican authorities who are always outgunned.
We're talking to David Shirk. He's associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of San Diego. He's the director of the Transborder Institute. We're talking about Mexico. Now, I mean, there's so many dimensions to the problems that Mexico is facing. And when you think about all the drugs flowing north, all the guns flowing south, although you say it's not just North America, American guns that are flowing south, there's a lot of them. And then you talk about the ways that you solve problems of violence. I find myself wondering whether problems of violence can be solved with guns in the first place. I mean, when you look at this whole picture, we have this problem in the United States is that every political problem in the world we think can be solved by sending in the military, and that's not always the case.
That's a really good point, and it raises this issue of, you know, the rhetoric of Mexico's a failed state, Mexico's a narco insurgency, Mexico's a counter is a narco terrorism problem, and that rhetoric comes from very particular interests, I think, in the U.S. establishment, that would like to take the same hammer we've used elsewhere in the world, the same hammer we've used in Iraq, the same hammer approach that we used in Colombia to a certain extent, and apply that hammer to Mexico. And that's a highly militarized approach to problems of violence that ultimately I'm not sure is really that effective. And in the worst case estimate, it actually makes the problem worse. So, you know, as Mexico brought the military in to fight the drug traffickers, some of those military defected and escalated the levels of violence.
And became drug traffickers.
Now we see grenades. We see other examples of military-grade weaponry employed in this particular conflict. So I think you need to take a more surgical approach to fighting organized crime. And so we can talk about legalizing drugs, and we can talk about reducing the flow of guns to Mexico, but neither of those two things are going to eliminate the problem of organized crime. They will weaken organized crime greatly, but at the end of the day, if in Mexico it is profitable or more profitable to go into organized crime than it is to get a decent law-abiding job, then that's what people are going to do. They're either going to choose a career in organized crime, or they're going to emigrate to the United States. So the biggest problem Mexico faces today as a society, and really for the last three or four decades, is the problem of poverty, inequality, and overall underdevelopment.
When you talk about young people, young men specifically, choosing to have a life in organized crime, specifically drugs, it kind of sounds like inner city Los Angeles.
No doubt. The comparison, I think, is very similar. And really, you want to understand the kind of violence we're talking about, all you have to do is go back to the 1980s in inner city Chicago, or the Crips and the Bloods fighting each other in Los Angeles. The problem for Mexico is that these kinds of localized conflicts are actually much more widely spread. The problem for Mexico is that organized crime is significantly more organized and more pervasive than it was at any point during the Prohibition era. And it is a country that has far less capacity in terms of law enforcement than we have always had in the United States. Certainly, U.S. law enforcement has had problems of corruption in the past and even into the present. And starting around the 1950s and 60s, that corrupt, unprofessional style of law enforcement that we had in the United States began to change. That change was partly driven by reform efforts in the U.S., things like increasing the rights of the accused. We saw an important landmark case in the United States called Gideon versus Wainwright around 1963, 1964, that made a public defender a right for anyone accused of a crime, which meant that basically the prosecutors had to step up their game and they had to be able to build a case and come up with good evidence.
You couldn't get a public defender before that?
It depended on the state that you were in, but you were not you did not have a right to a public defender prior to 1963.
Wow.
We also didn't have many lawyers were not did not have to go to law school to get a law degree. So the construction of the rule of law and professional law enforcement in the United States started in the 1960s. We started to actually see more scrutiny on police behavior and police corruption in the U.S. in the 1970s. You may remember the film Serpico. That was all about the exposure of organized crime networks in collusion with police in New York. Well, the same thing was happening in Chicago, in Los Angeles. And so if you think about it, we like to say the U.S. is the most advanced, most democratic and law-abiding society in the world. In actual fact, we've experienced major changes within one or two lifetimes in the way the rule of law works here in the United States that actually changed relatively quickly and fairly significantly. And Mexico is just beginning that process. Mexico recently, relatively recently, passed a series of reforms that look a lot like the due process reforms that we saw in the U.S. in the 1960s and the internal review reforms that we saw in anti-corruption reforms we saw in the U.S. in the 1970s. So it's beginning to reverse these historical patterns of corruption and abuse. But it took us three or four decades to get to where we are today. It means that Mexico's efforts to reform its judiciary, to professionalize its police forces, are probably going to take another 10 or 20 years. So what do you do in the meantime?
Well, and also, I mean, it's interesting that you give this U.S. example, because although our justice system is not entirely free of corruption and is not entirely fair in terms of who can afford a lawyer. I mean, even public defenders don't solve the whole problem and all of that. If we are an example to Mexico, it's still a tricky business to say, we, the United States, are going to teach you, Mexico, how to do it right, since we're the one with this society that is consuming massive amounts of drugs.
Yes, I think this is working with Woodrow Wilson Center a year and a half ago. We actually put out a book called Shared Responsibility, precisely because you have to recognize that this is a transnational problem. It is a binational responsibility on the part of both Mexico and the United States. It's very easy to point your finger at one or the other. Mexicans look north and they say, you guys are consuming all the drugs, you guys are supplying all the weapons and the cash. You're trafficking or funneling the money back through money laundering networks that reach into our most prestigious financial institutions, Wells Fargo and Bank of America.
They're money laundering.
The companies do not have a policy of money laundering, but the people who run those companies, who work within those companies, have been arrested, and those companies have been fined for supplying funds to Mexican organized crime groups. You have so much money moving across the border. You have to have efficient means of operating that financial infrastructure. The estimates vary quite a bit, but we suspect that at a minimum, the amount of profits from drug trafficking in the United States are somewhere between $6 and $7 billion. That's the lowest estimate out there. The Mexican government thinks it's more around $8 or $10 million dollars a year. Billion dollars a year. And the U.S. government estimates between $19 and $39 billion a year in profits. After a little while, a billion here, a billion there, it all looks
right, the
same. But we're talking about an extremely profitable industry that is facilitated in some ways by our financial infrastructure. It's facilitated by the vast availability of drugs. And most importantly, it's facilitated by the fact that Americans don't just say no to drugs. And I tell my students this. When I'm teaching a class, I say, look, you kids think more about where you buy your shoes and the moral consequences of buying Nike sneakers than you do about where you buy your drugs. And I think that the consumer has an individual responsibility to have researched their supply chain and to know that they're participating in an ethical consumption practice. But the reality is consumers of drugs in the United States don't care where they come from. They don't care who dies in order to get those drugs to them. And as long as that's true, and I think it's going to be true as long as people consume drugs, Mexico or some other poor third world country is going to have this problem.
And I mean, when you talk about consumption, and we'll talk about this more on other shows than we have in the past as well, but there are people who are real drug abusers and drug addicts and whose self-medication is a response to the society that they live in here, which is a big question. Then there are also people who are just kind of recreational users and never get addicted and
never cause problems.
Never cause problems.
They don't drive when they toke up on the weekend. They don't consume to the point that it becomes a health problem for themselves or for society. It is possible to responsibly use mind-altering substances like alcohol. We know that because we've legalized it and we've tried it. We also know that if it is abused, if it's used improperly, if it's used to excess, it can be very dangerous. And that's what we're really afraid of. I think we're all afraid of having our children become meth addicts. We're all afraid of becoming addicted to something like cocaine. And, you know, we need to figure out what's the best way to deal with that social ill that is drug consumption. Do we break out the guns and shoot all the drug traffickers, or do we figure out the deeper problems at root in our society that lead people to use drugs? It's much easier to break out the guns. It's much more complex to try to deal with the social causes and consequences of drug use. And
but
so we've
gone
the easy route.
We've gone the easy route, but on some level it looks like trying to deal with hepatitis by hitting it with a big stick.
Right.
It doesn't work.
No, I think that the disease metaphor is a really good one. This is something we have to recognize is epidemic. Drug use is epidemic. It's something that we can either treat as a medical problem and a social and sort of psychological or mental issue, or it's something that we can treat as a crime. And frankly, I think that people who are chemically dependent should be viewed not as criminals, but rather as people who have a serious health or mental health problem. And we can't deal with them on that level when we're throwing them behind bars.
Let's go back to Mexico. What are Mexico's options, in your view? I mean, we talked about Vicente Fox. We haven't talked much about Felipe Calderon, but what does the Mexican government, what does the world, including the U.S., have to give to this problem that you think might really actually be productive?
Well, you know, when we talk about Mexico, we talk about the drug trade, you know, and we talk about what's going on with U.S. policy, a lot of times people come back to me and say, yeah, well, what's Mexico doing about this problem? When are they going to deal with the corruption in their government? And I would say we have seen more evidence and more outing of corruption in Mexico in the last decade than ever before. And that's been a huge step forward. There are new transparency or freedom of information laws in Mexico that have helped to confront the problem of corruption in a properly democratic and constructive way. There is far more work that needs to be done in that regard. But I think one of the big things Mexico needed for many, many years was more transparency. In addition to that transparency, you have to have accountability, however. And that's where Mexico has really been lacking. Bringing people to justice is very difficult in Mexico, in part because people don't trust the authorities. Out of every, say, 100 crimes that's committed in Mexico, a full three-quarters is not reported. So for every 100 crimes, 75 are simply not reported because people don't trust or have confidence in the authorities. So for the 25 crimes that are reported, roughly 1 in 5, 20% of those are actually investigated because authorities are so overwhelmed they don't have the capacity to investigate every single crime. They investigate maybe 20%. So that's 5 out of the original 100 crimes that we were talking about. And of those crimes that are investigated, something like 2 or 3 of those are actually net a suspect and are brought to trial. Of those that are brought to trial, about 1.8, just under 2%, result in a conviction. So you can either look at the glasses 98% empty or 2% full. But the reality is that the administration of justice in Mexico is severely lacking. And that's partly because police are not properly equipped to do their job, either in terms of actual physical equipment or the training they receive, or frankly the supervision that goes on inside police agencies to make sure that cops are on the up and up. Part of the problem is also the judicial system, the judicial process in Mexico, which is not terribly efficient. Something like 40% of people behind bars in Mexico today are being held prior to sentencing. This is, in fact, prior to trial. So 40% of the people behind bars are technically not charged with a crime.
Yeah.
They're still in the process of being tried and sentenced. So this pretrial detention mechanism means that many people who supposedly are presumed innocent are actually behind bars, which is not fair to either the accused or to the victim, because in many cases it takes 2 or 3 years for that trial process to take place.
So an innocent person in the Mexican equivalent of the county detention center might be held for two years, lose their job, and not be able to feed their families, and they're innocent.
And if they're innocent, that means that an injustice is done to the victim as well, because the real perpetrator is out there somewhere.
Is out there doing something.
So this is something that we've been focused on really for the last 10 years, is how do we reform and improve the administration of justice in Mexico? And we have started to see some positive change. At the state level and at the local level, there have been major efforts to reform the administration of justice, new judicial sector reforms that actually try to take Mexico's traditional inquisitorial style of criminal procedure and make it more modern, more internationally prevalent system that relies on checks and balances in the judicial system, where you don't just have a prosecutor and a judge working together, which is the traditional system in Mexico, to try a particular crime. You actually have the prosecutor have to justify the evidence that he or she gathers in a court, in a transparent, open proceeding, where there is a public defender who says, no, that evidence was not properly gathered, or no, you didn't follow the law, or no, you tortured my client to get a confession. Now that they're putting in that kind of checks and balances, those due process rights, both for the victim and for the accused, we're starting to see the system, the bar is raised for the prosecutor, the bar is raised for the public defender, and we're starting to see real justice in Mexico.
And you're starting to actually really see that.
You're starting to see it on a very limited sort of test case basis in certain states that have begun to implement these reforms. The federal government passed a reform in 2008 that made it possible, or made it necessary, mandated that all states adopt this formula. Unfortunately, it won't fully come into effect by 2016, and it's lagging behind that estimated date of implementation. So it's happening slowly, it's happening on a small scale, but we're actually seeing some significant improvements to Mexico's justice system, and that's really important.
So we're just about out of time, but to continue this conversation, ladies and gentlemen, come to the James A. Little Theater tonight, and you can hear David Shirk, director of the Transborder Institute and professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of San Diego, speaking. It's at 6 o'clock, and it's part of the Lannan Foundation series called In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom, and you'll be also having a conversation with
Peter Smith.
Peter Smith, that's right.
He is easily the most eminent U.S. scholar of Latin America today, and it's a real privilege to have the opportunity to speak with him. He was one of my mentors in graduate school and very graciously agreed to moderate the conversation tonight.
Well, we look forward to it. David Shirk, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for bringing this attention to Mexico. It's really important.